Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast well outside the margin of error. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my partner of propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hello!
This week we're discussing whether or not we can trust the polls. How did the polls get it so wrong in 2015 and 2016? How much trust should we put into them in the election now? Stick with us to find out. Now, we've talked a lot on this podcast about 538, which is Nate Silver's site, and he made his name in America number crunching, looking at the polls and being generally quite accurate about which states were going to go to which presidential candidate. When Theresa May called the snap election, he wrote an article saying that the UK polls were so much more unreliable than those in the US or in France. In America, for instance, the national polls actually had the numbers right between Trump and Clinton by about 1 or 2 points. In the state polls, it was only about 2 or 3 points off. Whereas in the UK, the average over the past 30 years or so, UK polls have been off by an average of 6 points. So why do you think polls are much more unreliable here than in the US?
Well, I think part of that boils down to just that. In the US, when you're talking about polls, 90% of the things you end up looking at are going to be the presidential polls for the country as a whole, because doing anything smaller than that kind of level is actually very, very tricky. You can do state polling. It can be done very, very well. And indeed, that's how Nate Silver was able to make predictions that were very accurate previously. But I think for the UK, when you consider that the UK is about a population of about 60 million, mm-hmm. and the US is a population of 500 million, something like that.
It's give or take.
Yeah.
Depends how many Mexicans are going over the border at any particular time.
Yeah, especially, yeah. The bigger size makes it easier. What you've also got to consider, the US presidential elections aren't a single election, it's 50 different elections, well, which you have 50 separate state polls, which people tend to look for and look at. The UK has 656, or whatever it is, in the House of Commons. More often than not, they've not just got the two parties running in them. Like in most seats, you will have at least 4 or 5 just of the main parties standing, never mind any smaller parties or independents. Mm. And the size of those constituencies, on average, about 80,000, I think.
Yeah, they're trying to equalise. Yeah, between 50, 60 and 150, I think.
Yeah, exactly. The fact that you've got very, very small, very contained elections makes it very difficult to actually get an accurate read on what people's actions are going to be. Because when you ask people, how are you going to vote, they tend to think of the national picture. So you might think, I dislike the Conservatives, therefore I'm going to vote Labour. But in your seat, specifically, when it comes to election day and during the campaign, you get reminded, oh look, it's the Lib Dems who are my candidate and are already my MP or my local councillor, therefore I'll vote for them rather than Labour.
Hmm. And that's one factor, actually, that in 2015, when Nate Silver came over, he wrote an article afterwards on his experience. And one of the things that he said was a bigger factor in the UK than presidential politics often is incumbency advantage. Those MPs who tend to do better than the polls would suggest, and I'm sure a lot of Labour MPs are hoping this time that they'll outperform the polls. I know
the Lib Dems hope that as well.
Yeah, I suppose as well, as you say, the fact that in the US it's often two different candidates who voters know well, there probably isn't a lot of churn. If you look at the different numbers for Clinton and Trump throughout the presidential campaign,
pretty static.
It was pretty static, yeah. I think Clinton probably one time had a lead of 10, maybe 15 points. Whereas in the UK, the numbers changed quite quickly. I mean, look at Clegg-Mania. The Lib Dem polling figures just spiked up and then spiked down very quickly. And as you say, people thought about voting Lib Dem and then looked at the reality in their seat and thought, well, they're probably not going to get in. And I expect, actually, a lot of the reason why UKIP have shot off quite sharply in the last week or so. In the polls, before the election was called, a vote for UKIP was a protest at the national situation. And now, as you say, people are looking and thinking, well, actually, I don't want to vote for UKIP. I want to vote for that Theresa May. She's got insert slogan here.
Yeah, pretty much. Incumbency is one of those interesting factors which gets talked up an awful lot, primarily by people who are worried about losing their seats. In my experience, talked up Lib Dem incumbency when I used to be a member and said that, oh, this will clearly be fine. People love our local MPs. And at the end of the day, it made no difference. You know, you dropped from 56 to down to 8 seats. Incumbency didn't really play a factor there at all.
And again, that's the difference between a multi-party system and a two-party system, yeah, where you can't have wipeouts like the SNP in Scotland, and you couldn't really have the wipeout of the Lib Dem in 2015. And in France, the polls are very accurate as well, maybe because it's more a presidential personality system. The French election polls, although they changed a lot during the campaign, and there were surges at one point for Fillon and for Macron, not for Hamo, the Socialist Party, but certainly the first round of the French presidential election, look at the exit polls there, they were remarkably similar to the first round results.
I think with France, again, it kind of boils down to the electoral system that they have in place there. I think for the first round, it's just one competition. It's one seat that people are voting for there. And again, so it's very easy to take a national picture of one person, of people contesting for a single seat, in effect.
And I get, we've mentioned this book before, Sex, Lies and the Ballot Box, which is a collection edited by Phil Cowley. It's a book, there's two books now, and I'd really recommend them. They're basically political scientists writing short, pithy, readable essays about their area of expertise. It's a wonderful idea, and it'd be nice, I'd like to see for other academic disciplines as well. I can imagine it being really good for economists or historians, but that's a separate issue. But
if you've ever wanted to know about the sex lives of political party members and voters, this is the book for you. There is an entire chapter on the fantasies and sexual proclivities of Lib Dems, Labour, UKIP, Tories.
That's another podcast, obviously. Maybe a Valentine's Day special. Maybe
we can have see if we can get the author on.
But so Matt Singh wrote an article about why the polls were so inaccurate in 2015. And there were three main reasons that he came up with. One of them is just simply the polls were unrepresentative, is that they managed to speak to more Labour than more Tory voters.
I've always found that quite an interesting notion, though, because when you consider who Labour voters traditionally are, now granted we're going through a bit of a realignment here in terms of the demographics of who's voting for what party, you would say in all likelihood that Labour voters would be much harder to reach. Working class, they're going to be more likely to be working at the time of the day, a lot of the times when these kind of phone polls and things are happening, they're much less likely to be higher educated, which means they're much less likely to be online for YouGov polling, for instance. So you would think that would go the other way. So it's quite interesting that it didn't.
I think that's interesting. Maybe one reason for that, Luke John Davis was saying in earlier podcasts, Labour's becoming more the party of the professionals than the working class. Maybe that has something to do with it. But I think other reasons maybe go into the final couple of the reasons. So the second reason that he mentioned is that the people who tended to answer the polls, they tended to be the ones who were more interested in politics. So if you put them on a scale of 1 to 10, how interested they are in politics, they're more likely to be 8, 9, 10, rather than 1, 2, 3.
Yeah.
And what that means is that those who were underrepresented in the poll, they tended to be those who are not really that into politics. They don't really vote in local elections. They don't really vote in European elections. But they do vote in general elections. Now, that particular group of voter, they voted Tory by a big margin in 2015. And that's probably the group that swung it, I would say.
Mm, yeah.
And so then, I suppose, related to that, the previous polling debacle before the 2015 election was 1992. And in 1992, we seemed to have what was deemed the shy Tory effect. So this idea, essentially, that people were lying or not being entirely truthful to pollsters about who they were going to vote for. So they said they'd vote Labour because they didn't want to seem like an evil Tory, and then they got in the ballot box, thought about the prospect of Neil Kinnock as Prime Minister, and went the other way. So after those elections, people looked far more at the political makeup of polls. So trying to make sure the polls they had were representative in terms of how they voted at the last general election.
Yep.
The voter churn that we saw in 2015 was basically unprecedented. I mean, we talked about the rise of the SNP vote, we talked about the rise of the UKIP vote, we talked about the collapse of the Lib Dem vote as well, which meant a lot of those marginals went to the Conservatives. Because the pollsters, I think, were trying very, very hard to get a politically representative sample, because it didn't factor in that there were so many changing voters those polls ended up not being very representative. Mm-hmm. For instance, one thing that the cephologists were all saying is that the Tories would need 42-43% of the vote to get an overall majority, because they thought the Lib Dems would hold up in those southwest seats, because that vote didn't hold up in those seats. Actually, it turned out they needed much less of the vote to get a majority.
Yeah, and again, that fabled incumbency didn't happen, or wasn't a strong enough factor to actually hold back the blue tide. I'm beginning to think that incumbency is quite an overrated factor. It certainly has an impact, but I don't think it's actually the be-all or end-all. If the national mood is against you, then chances are you're going to be hit by it one way or another.
I think that's definitely the case in the local elections. I mean, we didn't really make the point in the podcast we did last week on the local election results that a lot of good councillors, most of them Labour, would have lost their jobs. And that's not really a reflection on the local councillors. It's just a reflection of national swing, really.
Yeah, pretty much.
Mm. The problem with the polls, often it's not so much that the numbers are unreliable. I think what's often not great is the reporting of them and how those polls feed into the media narrative. I mean, we talked a bit after the Brexit referendum. You said the polls were a toss-up. And the referendum result was a toss-up, but that wasn't really how the media was portraying it.
No, the media was very much going in with the notion that, oh, it was Remain was clearly in the lead, Remain was clearly in the lead. And yeah, when you actually looked at the polls, it was certainly a lot closer than they were making out, to the point where it was well within margin of error that lead could have taken over. Especially in the last couple of weeks of the referendum campaign, it was more or less a 50-50 split once you took into account the margin of error. So there is definitely an issue with the way that people interpret and read polls. A lot of it boils down to, certainly from the media's perspective, is that they need a nice story, a hook to keep whatever that is going on is interesting. The campaign stays exactly the same as it has been from beginning to end. It doesn't sell newspapers. It doesn't get you clicks online. Whilst reading something into polls or turning a poll into something that it's not necessarily saying, but you can kind of spin it, can deliver all of that. And at the end of the day, as businesses, that's what they're all about. They're not actually about, you know, serving up truth and justice or anything like that. They are about making money.
And hence, I suppose, the pushing of rogue polls or outlier polls to show particular swings one way or the other, but don't turn out to be accurate.
Clickers, as I believe Jody Avragan from the 538 podcast tried to get them named.
The US election is another great example, I think, of how the reporting of polls kind of is skewed. As I say, the polls were well within the margin of error, especially in some of the other states, the swing states, it was too close to call. If you look at the 538 tracker, they had Trump, I think, on maybe a 20, maybe a 30, 35% chance of winning. So one in three chance, sometimes one in five. Whereas the way that a lot of other media outlets were reporting on the prospect of a Trump victory, they were talking about how Clinton
less
had
less than a percent.
Less than a percent, less than 5%, less than 10%, which made it such a big shock. Whereas actually, I think I remember saying in the "Are We Are Doomed" episode last year that if you wouldn't go out the house if you thought you had a 1 in 5 chance of being hit by a car. But the media was reporting it almost as a done deal. Maybe that's one of the reasons why the Comey email was reported as much as it was. They didn't think Clinton had a chance of losing, and so maybe wanted to make the houses a bit more competitive. It's hard to do.
Potentially. I mean, it certainly looks like the way that the media reported on that Comey letter had an impact on the election. Again, Nate Silver from 538 recently wrote a piece looking at the impact that he thinks it had, and he estimates that on the low end it had a 1-2% impact on the overall polling. And you know, it doesn't sound like a lot, but when you consider the states that put Trump over the top and meant Hillary Clinton lost by 1-2%, well, that's enough to change the result of the election completely.
Yeah, it's one of those things, isn't it, where the election result was so close that actually every little thing does matter.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, we talked about the 92 election. I think the 92 election is maybe an example where the reporting of the polls and the position of the polls led to hubris by one of the parties as well. So, I mean, you saw Neil Kinnock's Sheffield rally and the We're All Right.
Yeah.
There was a lot of triumphalism which wasn't really borne out by events, and it was almost like a victory rally before the main event. And that's why I suppose you're seeing a lot now of the Tory campaign is trying to ward off complacency and talking about how we're not complacent.
Yeah, and I think there's And I think that actually is explains an awful lot of the way that the Tories are fighting the campaign. They are desperately trying to make sure that their base maintains activity, desperately trying to make sure that everything maintains on the focus on things that they want to talk about, because they know that's what will get their people out the door and to the voting booth on the actual election day itself. Things like the dead cats issues that we discussed in a previous podcast. So Theresa May standing outside of Downing Street and accusing the EU of election interfering in the British election, you know, with no real evidence of the sort at all, basically designed to try and rile up the Brexiteer base, get them engaged and make sure that they do turn out. So yeah, I'd say there is the Tories have learned from previous mistakes that have been made by political parties, and they are desperate to try and make things look closer than they actually are. Hence the talk of the coalition of chaos and things like that.
You're repeating the attack lines against
you. When you go through everything that they are saying and doing, it does look like they are desperately trying to make sure that their voters don't get too complacent, because that complacency could be the difference between a 80-seat majority and a 150-seat majority.
I'm almost a bit too depressed to speak at that. Perhaps one thing that I suppose actually probably lead to complacency, but one of the other essays in the Sex, Lies and Balance book is by Mark Pack, who's the Lib Dem blogger. And one of the things that he talks about is the fact that in every election since 1964, apart from two, the party ahead in the polls in January has also been the party that was ahead of the polls at the election. Two exceptions to that. One was in 1974, when the Tories were ahead in terms of national vote share, but Labour ended up with more seats. So there was a second election where Wilson increased the majority.
Yeah.
Or I should say, a second election where Wilson took it from a minority government to a small majority. And then the other one was 2015, which was different for the reasons we've talked about before. That's the difference between signal and noise, isn't it, in terms of what Nate Silver would talk about, is that you've got really a lot of the stuff that we're going to talk about in the next 3 or 4 weeks. A lot of that isn't really relevant. Maybe it's the difference in scale of majority, or maybe it's the difference... I'm still being optimistic. It's the difference between a small Tory majority or a massive Tory majority. But actually, the polls in January, Tories were ahead quite convincingly. They have been
For two and a half years. Yeah, I mean, there's actually a fair bit of evidence to suggest that the actual election campaigns themselves, at least in the UK, don't shift votes particularly. People come to their decisions based on long-term impressions of candidates and of parties. So the fact that Labour is viewed negatively up and down the country by the electorate means that, to a certain extent, doesn't matter what you do in the election campaign, Labour are going to take a kick in because of it. It's the issue that the Lib Dems had last time round. The fact that they were viewed as being sellouts, the fact that they were viewed to have broken their promises, that set in really early on. They were never able to shift that narrative. That's how people viewed them, therefore that's how that influenced how people voted.
I think you can say the same with perceptions of Jeremy Corbyn as well.
Yes.
The fact that coming out, not singing the national anthem, all that kind of thing, that did define his leadership right from the very start.
Yeah, I mean, Corbyn is a classic example, along with Ed Miliband, of letting your opponents define you. Miliband was just through inaction and not getting it right, whilst Corbyn is just complacency around that sort of thing, I think, is the reason behind it. We've kind of touched on this in previous episodes as well, but that moment where Miliband was photographed eating a bacon sandwich in a weird way kind of became the ultimate depiction of him. But it only worked because people thought it had a grain of truth to it. The fact that Ed Miliband was this nerdy, geeky guy who wasn't really in touch with everybody else, and here he is kind of pulling a weird gurn whilst trying to eat a bacon butty, one of the most basic foodstuffs to most people.
It's one of your five basic food groups.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Bacon, sausage, beans and mash, right? Corbyn's got a similar problem in that the minute he started running and got onto the ballot and started doing well, everybody was focusing on who he was and what he's done. The fact that he was friends with the IRA, the fact that he stood up with Hezbollah and various other extreme radical Islamist groups, the fact that he was chairman, I believe, of the Stop the War Coalition, the fact that he appeared on Russia Today and Press TV, which is an Iranian-controlled channel. All of these things got reported, and no one really counted them. So the first introduction that most people had to Jeremy Corbyn was, here's all this dodgy stuff that Jeremy Corbyn's done.
And I think as well is that Labour's allowed themselves to be defined by the Tories. Well, since the 2010 election, when we had a long leadership contest, and the Tories filled the void by talking about Labour overspending, the deficit, Labour's legacy.
Yeah.
I mean, thank heavens we're not going to have a long, protracted Labour leadership election this year in which the Tories are going to define us again.
Yeah, let's hope not.
That would be terrible, wouldn't it? On that note, we are going to be back with a podcast. We might have a podcast for you in the week. If not, we'll definitely have one on Sunday, and we'll review the latest thrills and spills from the election campaign. Our theme tune is Pookie Good Times by Dave Depper, and that's from freemusicarchive.org. And our logo is designed by James Cram. You can follow him on Twitter at James Cram. I'm at Paperback Writer.
And I'm at Sender Radical.
John and Bridget still aren't back. They're still foraging for food. If you do see them, can you throw them a bone or a biscuit or some votes or something? We're a little bit worried now. It's been a couple of weeks.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Anyway, speak to you soon.
Thing with the French polling will be to look at how it compares after the presidential election, obviously, but also looking forward to the House elections, because there are some polls which have seemingly come out which are suggesting that En Marche, Emmanuel Macron's party, are going to just completely eclipse the traditional Social Democratic Party in there and basically form a new left alignment in there. If those polls are wrong, then it's something that's massively off somewhere. So
it's Clegmania with a beret.
Yeah, exactly. And some baguettes.
We don't go for national stereotyping here, do we? Not at all.